I think a good amount hinges on if the SEC applies its market manipulation interpretations that it took for Bitcoin to Ethereum. So for Bitcoin, they use the existence of the futures market, a regulated market of significant size is the wording. If they approach the Ethereum futures market through the same lens, there should be room for a spot Ethereum ETF, but that's an open question.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Opto Sessions. I'm excited to welcome Matt Siegel today, Head of Digital Asset Research at VanEck. How are you doing, Matt?
Hi, happy to be here.
Where are you calling from today? Is it New York, VanEck office?
Yeah, Midtown Manhattan, right next to Grand Central.
Is it cold there at the moment?
We had our first snowstorm in a couple of years, wow. You know, well below zero. So winter is here.
They shut down the road.
No, they don't shut down the roads.
Okay.
Yeah. But the office has been full. The crypto team is pretty much in person 5 days a week. New asset class. So requires a lot of communication internally.
Yeah. Exciting time. So there's a whole team there for crypto.
Yes. Our trader is in Amsterdam, but the analysts and PMs are here.
Oh, wow. That's great. So there's an Amsterdam office as well for VanEck.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because Europe was, you know, historically much more friendly to listing crypto ETFs.
Yes.
So we have long established Bitcoin and Ethereum spot ETF products in Europe.
Okay.
Close to $500 million in those products.
Yeah. Amazing. Yeah. Obviously, it's a momentous time to start talking about this sort of thing. There's obviously Bitcoin ETF launched last week. It's actually Jan 17th today that we're talking about it. But yeah, obviously there's been some wild price movements in the run-up to the ETF launch and in the immediate aftermath of it going live as well. I just thought we could start by discussing the price action since launch, which hasn't been that long, but it has moved considerably. And getting your thoughts on it, basically.
Bitcoin ran up, 60% plus in November and December on the back of flows into existing ETF products, like the ones that we manage in Europe. Collectively, Bitcoin ETFs gathered about $1 billion in flows in each of November and December, and that was good for a 60% gain. Now we've had close to $1 billion in flows just in 3 days of US ETF trading, and the price is down. So for those wondering what's going on, we think there was a considerable amount of speculative positioning that was in the asset class just for the short-term ETF momentum. And we've also seen Bitcoin miners begin to sell their coins rather aggressively over the last couple days. We can observe on the blockchain the flows from Bitcoin miners onto crypto exchanges have been historically large.
Yeah.
And it makes sense because with the Bitcoin halving now just 100 days away, when new supply will be cut in half, it's going to become a much more challenging time to be a Bitcoin miner. Essentially, their cost bases are going to double, and some of them may be looking to fortify their balance sheets ahead of that event.
Yeah.
And also, if you look at the kind of aggregate amount of profits held by Bitcoin holders, short-term Bitcoin holders, so those who've held their coins for less than 6 months, those gains exceeded 20% in aggregate, and that tends to be a level that starts to bring some sellers into the market.
Okay.
So, we think we're kind of digesting the recent gains, that a lot of the early flows into the ETFs have been from retail. Institutions have not yet begun to deploy. So, it's possible to have a period of sideways, choppy price action ahead of the halving, given the dynamic for miners, given the fact that these institutional flows may be slow to materialize, given the fact that there was a bit of froth in the funding markets, funding rates, exceeded 20% in early January. So taking a little bit of air out of that over the last few days.
Mm-hmm. And we're talking about the miners and the short-term sort of selling plan they've got to fund their sort of balance sheet. How considerable is that in comparison to the flows that you're seeing coming in? Is it feasible that they're large enough that they're impacting the price, are they?
That's a good question. I need to go and look at the data to size it exactly correctly for you.
Is it hundreds of millions of pounds worth or something like this?
Okay, so if you look at miner flows onto exchanges over the course of the last 2 years, they've tended to average just in kind of the $3 to $5 million amount daily. And in the last 2 weeks, we've had multiple days where that number exceeds $20 million. Okay. So it's lumpy, and it's too early to say, whether this is going to be a long-term trend, but there have been notable spikes over the last couple of weeks.
And am I right in saying a certain amount of investment into the ETF or the, so say 100 million comes in, can have a disproportional impact on the actual price because of the way the mechanics of how it works are? Is that because so many, there's only so much liquid supply available? Is that right?
So just to give you some math around how these flows might impact the price. So Bitcoin block occurs every 10 minutes. There's 6.25 Bitcoin per block. So that's 900 per day. At $42,000 Bitcoin, that's about $40 million a day, roughly $1 billion per month. So this is why I keep kind of mentioning like the November and December dynamic is that the ETF flows into the European and Canadian products plus the MicroStrategy purchases were absorbing all of the incremental supply of new Bitcoin. And if we were to remain on this pace for ETF flows in the US, now that they're trading, we've done $1 billion of inflows in 4 trading days. That would also exceed the new issuance. And when the halving comes in April, it could be twice the new issuance. So we do think that the flow into these products can make a meaningful dent in new supply, but really only to the extent that this is passive programmatic buying, right? So the early orders have been retail, and we are not seeing flows from institutional 60/40 products that are putting retirement money to work every single month. And I think that's going to be, the really exciting dynamic that may occur in the second half of the year. There's been a lot of focus on the brokers who have not listed these products on their platforms. So, Vanguard took a lot of heat for that, but there have been others like Merrill Lynch, UBS, Citi. We are working with some of those advisors, and often the advisors there follow the asset allocation models set at headquarters that are some version of a 60/40 portfolio. So we're optimistic that we're going to see asset allocation models from these brokerages that may include 1 or 2% in Bitcoin as a substitute for an allocation to, say, U.S. sovereign debt or G10 sovereign debt. And those are the type of flows that can be repeatable every month. and which I think might cause the type of parabolic Bitcoin price action that is customary post previous halvings.
And so do you see this is basically a point in time for Bitcoin where it can cross the chasm and, you know, finally institutional adoption becomes regular, and also, you know, retailers start properly embracing it as an asset they keep on their portfolio as well?
Yes and no. I still think that Bitcoin is a polarizing asset, and there are going to be very high-profile haters, even when and if the price hits $100,000. I think that there will be some institutions that are willing to lose market share to maintain some type of perceived reputation, right? Obviously, we think that's going to be a demerit, not a merit. Yeah. But I'm not making a call that everyone is going to embrace Bitcoin just because the price goes up.
Yeah. And how have the access costs changed since the introduction of these new products?
Yeah, we've been optimistic that the most appealing part of these ETFs is their cost savings for retail and the security advantages for institutional. But for a retail investor who's just clicking the buy button on Coinbase, they are paying 2.5% transaction costs. These products are generally trading at less than 1% deviation to their net asset value. They're trading at, you know, less than 25 basis points of bid-ask spreads. So there is a sizable all-in cost savings to the end investor that we think will be compelling. And history kind of shows us that when new technologies become more accessible to the masses because of costs, that tends to catalyze a wider adoption. So the early trading in these ETFs was at, let me start over. In the first day of trading for these ETFs, we saw relatively wider bid-ask spreads, some sizable deviations from net asset value. But over the last couple days, those spreads have come down. The premiums to NAV have come down. The cost savings are starting to materialize in the way that we envisioned.
Yeah, that's really interesting. For some reason, I hadn't even thought about the cost savings that would be involved from that perspective. Obviously, they're a yearly cost, but still, you'd need multiple years to even touch on a 2.5% fee.
Exactly. Yeah, and I think that, you know, the killer use case for Bitcoin is obviously to hold it and self-custody it, and be able to transact with anyone in the world, you know, 365, 24/7. The ETFs don't enable that, but they do make it a lot easier for Wall Street to speculate on this asset. You know, that's still an important part of the capital formation process. And so for the shorter term speculators, the ETF should provide some advantage in terms of their ability to integrate with existing holdings and the cost savings.
Yep. And you see financial advisors building these sort of products into their portfolios they're constructing for their clients?
Yeah, we can see that, and we're engaged with some of these larger banks and brokerages who are working on asset allocation models that include Bitcoin. You know, UBS is a famous one that was kind of shamed on Twitter for not offering the Bitcoin ETF to clients in the early days. But we know that actually they do make those products available if you have $10 million in net worth. And they're going to be lowering that number to $1 million or below and coming out with a framework of how advisors can integrate this asset into their investment policy statements. So when we build some of those models as well, 60-40 models, and some of the more aggressive flavors, we've integrated Bitcoin as well. We've also noticed that some of the mutual funds and ETFs that are trading balanced mutual funds that hold kind of 60-40 or are benchmarked to 60-40 indices, they've started amending their prospectuses to allow them to invest in these spot Bitcoin ETFs. So those institutional players may be kind of the first movers here, the ones that are nimble enough to change their prospectus and integrate, you know, 1, 2, 3% Bitcoin holding as a substitute to some of the sovereign debt that they hold.
And for your sort of standard retail investor, how would you incorporate this into a portfolio? Is there sort of way that they should approach adding a Bitcoin ETF, like in terms of allocation size, or how they should consider it in like what bundle with other assets?
Yeah, the funny thing about doing this work with an asset that's the best performing asset in the world over 1 year, 3 year, 5 year, 10 year, and since inception is that it just always looks better no matter how much you hold. So, you know, the challenge for advisors is to strike the right balance around the volatility that they're willing to subject their clients to. So we land at the, you know, kind of 2-4% range, but each client's got to have their own view on that, and I think that's part of the challenge that the banks and brokers are working their way through right now.
And what in terms of the volatility of the asset, how should people approach being comfortable with that? Should they just, if anyone's going to buy it, they should just be comfortable knowing that during the, you know, any even like a bullish run, there's 30% drawdowns. Is that sort of the way they should look at it? And if they're comfortable with that and they know that they can handle it, then that's the sort of way they can move forward with it.
Yeah. Currently, Bitcoin is trading at about 4 times the annualized volatility of the S&P 500. So, you know, there's high octane in that tank.
Yeah.
And the investors who we've engaged with are, you know, willing to lose that money, right? Willing to handle a 70% drawdown and add more in that situation. This is an asset that's just, it's uniquely disposed to dollar cost averaging. We're a big fan of dollar cost averaging. You know, the crypto meme for that is HODL, I guess. Always be buying. TradFi equivalent is dollar cost averaging.
Yeah. And I had a question on, now the ETF is live and it provides essentially is a very liquid way for Wall Street traders to get access to an instrument like this. Do you think that they might have strategies that push around the market for their, you know, for their own benefit? Or do you perceive that not happening? But just like you do in other financial markets, it's not unique to Bitcoin.
I think we have observed a lot of people are wondering, like, what ETFs will be next now that these spot products are in the market. And what we've seen so far from sponsors is that they are filing covered call strategies, so selling Bitcoin calls in order to generate some income. They are filing levered products, so there are 1.5 and 2x levered, both long and short Bitcoin products that have been filed. These types of ETFs require credit to operate, so, you know, perhaps the launch of these ETFs can catalyze a new Bitcoin credit cycle because there's going to be demand for leverage from market makers and sponsors who are trying to provide those types of levered returns.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And you can see that in the funding markets where the cost of kind of rolling Bitcoin futures or borrowing against Bitcoin collateral, those rates have ticked higher. So they really spiked ahead of the ETF, got north of 20%, and isolated instances north of 50%, very heated. They've come down to around 7%, is kind of the cost of funding a Bitcoin collateral on Binance right now. That's still elevated versus the last year. Yeah. I think it reflects, you know, somewhat heightened demand for credit given these products that are launching. And meanwhile, the credit is still supply constrained because nearly all the entities that were offering such credit in the last cycle went bankrupt, all of them, right? FTX, Alameda, Celsius, Voyager, BlockFi, the list goes on.
Has the Bitcoin ETF paved the way for an Ethereum ETF come around the corner? There's been a lot of speculation about that. What's your thoughts on that?
Somewhat limited on what I can say there because we, VanEck has filed for spot Ethereum ETF. The deadline on that filing is May 23rd. I think a good amount hinges on if the SEC applies its market manipulation interpretations that it took for Bitcoin to Ethereum. So for Bitcoin, they use the existence of the futures market. A regulated market of significant size is the wording. If they approach the Ethereum futures market through the same lens, then there should be room for spot Ethereum ETF, but that's an open question.
Yeah. And I just wanted your thoughts on the global sort of adoption of digital assets more generally. I think notably India recently blocked the websites of a whole list of basically the major exchanges in the world. I think India has been, I believe, one of the countries that's adopted cryptocurrency the most in the world and use it extremely frequently, and it's very widespread. But obviously the government's taking a relatively restricted stance to it. Do you see the world polarized in this way where countries either support it or are against it?
I think that India news is maybe a little bit more nuanced. India famously put a tax on all crypto exchange transactions a couple of years ago, and that, you know, put some lid on the innovation in the space there. The move over the last couple of weeks was more about protecting local upstarts. CoinDCX, for example, is a local player. They were not impacted by that move, whereas Binance, being a foreign player, was. So, in India, it's a bit of a nuanced environment. I do think that the strong move higher in the Bitcoin price late last year, in part due to the ETF optimism and flows that we discussed, but it also occurred in tandem with a sharply weaker dollar in both November and December after the FOMC signaled U.S. rate cuts were probable in Q1. You had the BRICS group expand to include five additional countries, including Saudi Arabia, UAE, Iran, Egypt, Ethiopia, and the market, we think, was taking cues from some significant crypto policy support outside the U.S., where adoption is obviously more apparent. And some examples of that were the Nigerian Central Bank, which made a major policy change in December, reversed the ban that had prohibited banks from servicing virtual asset providers. You had an influential Saudi Arabian cleric who acknowledged Bitcoin as permissible. And then Argentina's new administration declared that contracts settled in Bitcoin would be legal under certain conditions. And we think that's a theme for this year. There's 50% of the world population that's voting in presidential or legislative elections in 2024. That number is an all-time high going back to 200 years. So with such a high percentage of elections, there's a lot of opportunity for disruption, change, uncertainty, and then resolution. And markets tend to love that environment. The Bitcoin four-year halving cycle was set to correspond with the presidential cycle intentionally by Satoshi. And it just so happens it's also converging with the liquidity cycle in the U.S. As well. So to directly answer your question, I do think that there is polarization, that there are some countries that are kind of getting strong-armed by IMF and others to maybe take a stronger anti-crypto policy footing than they might normally. But on the other side of that, there's countries that see it in their interest to accelerate the adoption of this asset class for that very reason, to piss off some of these multilateral institutions. Yeah. El Salvador being the obvious example, Argentina potentially following.
And you briefly touched on the Bitcoin halving there, which is obviously coming up relatively soon. I thought we could just discuss that quickly. How do you foresee price changing in the run-up to the halving and also post-halving? And what's your comment on historically that around about a year after the halving, you see that peak price appreciation? Do you think that will happen again? Or is it a similar sort of trend, or have things changed?
Yeah, so for background, the way the halving works, right now, each Bitcoin block every 10 minutes contains 6.25 Bitcoin in rewards to miners who successfully solve the algorithm. And about 100 days from today, early to mid-April, the Bitcoin algorithm will change again, and that reward rate will drop to 3.125 Bitcoin every 10 minutes. So assuming that there is some passive flow into this asset class from market makers or maximalists or asset managers like Van Eck, who are buying every month programmatically, putting a percentage of earnings into BTC, if there's suddenly a supply shock and new supply is cut by half, then the price should theoretically react strongly and at least double over the subsequent 6 to 12 months. That's been the history of each prior halving. The details around how and when that price appreciation occurs, you can think about the game theory of a Bitcoin miner who, let's say, is earning kind of low margins but profitable right in front of the halving. Suddenly, they become unprofitable. They're losing money post-halving, and they have a few choices of how to deal with that. And some number of Bitcoin miners are forced to start selling more of their existing coins or even all of the coins that they mine just to pay the expenses. That creates some flood of new supply. And the miners who are profitable may wait a little while, or other entities may wait a little while before stepping in and buying aggressively, because they can observe, okay, here's X percent of the cost curve that is unprofitable. They may be puking out their coins. They may be shutting down their mines. They may be going bankrupt. When do we step in? And the miners who are able to leave the power on during that potentially tough environment will pick up market share of the overall hash rate. So they'll earn more rewards than they did potentially pre-halving. Mm-hmm. And if that is combined with a price that is moving higher, then they can really make hay. But the timing of that, can be somewhat uncertain. And there are examples where Bitcoin price can drop, 20% or more in the immediate days or weeks following the halving while we wait for that consolidation to occur. And then you tend to get these parabolic price action. So our best guess, which is a roadmap, not necessarily a prediction subject to change, is that we may not see the really explosive gains until the U.S. election uncertainty is resolved. That would mean Q4. If you recall, the Bitcoin's last all-time high post the 2017 run-up, so we're talking 2020, occurred several weeks after the election resolution. I think it was late November. So that would be a roadmap for BTC making all-time highs again would be Q4 after the U.S. election.
Yeah. Interesting. And it's everyone's been talking about the election years and how normally very positive, supported by the Federal Reserve, et cetera, in their sort of policies that they're moving forward. In terms of everyone expecting rate cuts this year, I don't know if you had a point of view on that, if they've almost sort of trying to price it in already. Do you think they will have a number of rate cuts this year, and to what extent that might be, and will that support digital assets going forward?
There's no doubt that the FOMC appears to have pivoted and wants to make credit more available, either by stopping rate hikes or explicitly cutting rates. We don't have an explicit call on how many of those rate cuts might materialize, but we do have conviction that the U.S. fiscal position is worsening, is quite poor by historical standards, and is unlikely to improve. And that is really where we see the value of Bitcoin, is potentially protecting folks from fiat debasement. And we can see from the interest costs on federal debt, which now exceed our military expenditures, that these high rates are pretty painful and are likely to require, continued deficits. And we can observe geopolitically from the numerous wars in the world right now that a pretty sizable percentage of other countries don't appreciate the U.S. government's fiscal house right now. Certainly don't want to fund war in their own backyard by buying our debt. And yet the amount of new debt issuance this year is going to grow. So that's why we're keen to populate these new models that replace a portion of sovereign debt with a couple percentages of Bitcoin. And when you look around the world at the countries that are mining Bitcoin for their own reserves, it's El Salvador, it's UAE, it's Oman and Bhutan. It's countries in Middle East, Latin America, Asia, where penetration is rising and where objections to the U.S. fiscal situation can be expressed through this new asset class. Now, again, we don't have an explicit call on how many Fed rate cuts there'll be. And, if inflation stays sticky, one of the complaints about Bitcoin during the last cycle was that it didn't hedge during a period of rising inflation. And why is that? I think that's because that governments and policymakers saw this rising inflation. The ruling parties in most G10 countries, U.S., Canada, kind of took the view that the inflation was driven by greedy corporations and supply chain issues, and it can all be fixed if we can just micromanage this financial system a little bit more. So in that micromanagement is, it's an illness, which is anti-crypto, in my view, right? Just folks trying to micromanage financial flows to the detriment of Bitcoin and other open source technologies. So that's always a risk, is that the political winds, shift again, and we get term two of Gary Gensler. That would probably not be positive for crypto adoption in the U.S.
Do you think there's a strong possibility that moving forward, Bitcoin can be perceived as a hedge against inflation, essentially.
Yes, definitely. And that's the, I think that's the message, especially outside the US. There's hundreds of millions of people living in countries with inflation above 30% annually. And we can observe from the Chainalysis crypto adoption indices, from exchange volumes in LATAM, Middle East, Asia, where we have some venture investments, that that's where penetration is rising the fastest. And when you ask people why, it is to protect against their own fiat evaluation. That message just doesn't really resonate with kind of the privileged financial folks in the U.S. If you listen to how some of these ETF sponsors are marketing it, it's more of a safety asset is kind of how, like, BlackRock, for example, is marketing it. But we're being more explicit. Bitcoin may help guard your money against government debasement.
And could you just touch on what other blockchain products you have at VanEck?
Yeah. So we have 18 different crypto strategies. The majority are single token and multi-token ETFs in Europe and now the US. We do run a couple of private liquid token strategies that are focused on the ex-Bitcoin part of the market, trying to undercover which smart contract platforms are operating in large addressable markets with winner-take-all characteristics and with tokens that are engineered to return value to their holders. We're focused on the most prominently the Ethereum and Solana ecosystems, mm-hmm. and trying to uncover which applications can take market share from their centralized equivalents. We're also building in the space. We have an NFT project called Segment that tries to bring some new functionality to the sharing and dividing of NFTs. So that'll go live here over the next couple quarters. We have a strategic partnership with an early stage venture manager called Cadenza, focused on seed and pre-seed investments in the blockchain space. And we occasionally will co-invest alongside them. Some of those investments include emerging markets based crypto exchanges, and we're also exploring some of the intersection of crypto and AI.
Wow. I didn't realize the extent to how big your operations were in digital assets. So you really sort of built in that into your philosophy and growth story moving forward.
Yeah, when we first tried to bring Spot Bitcoin ETF to market in 2017, and when it became clear that TradFi sponsor, the Winklevoss twins were first in 2013, mm-hmm. and that's one reason why we chose Gemini as our custodian for these Bitcoin ETFs. But when we realized that the regulator was not going to allow these products, we looked for other ways to get exposure to the space. And one way was to start writing checks into venture. We're the seed and largest investor in both of Cadenza's funds and have invested in other managers as well, partially as a way to build relationships and credibility in this space. We see the whole space as essentially venture. You can either have it in illiquid form or in liquid token form. And we get some good synergies from working on the early stage part of the market as well.
Yeah. Amazing. Well, Matt, it's been great to catch up today. Really interesting to get your insights, especially at such an interesting time in the history of digital assets. Is there anything else you'd like to leave the audience with today before we wrap up?
I'd just say that, you know, there's a lot of these Bitcoin ETFs on the market. It's a, you know, great opportunity for investors to get a cost-effective access vehicle. You know, they are all quite similar. We think that we've differentiated by making the largest seed investment. We put $70 million of our own money into this product. We always invest alongside of our clients. It's the largest such seed by a factor of three of any of the 10 funds. And we're trying to differentiate with our research and our integration with the crypto community, donating a percentage of our profits back to Bitcoin core developers and trying to add value to the space with new takes on modeling the economic viability of some of these projects. So I would encourage everyone to go on our website, take a look at the research, and that's all.
Yeah, very nice. The research is very good. I've looked at that quite thoroughly as well. So yeah, congrats to getting that together. Thanks, Matt. Have a great rest of the day, and I hope to catch up with you sometime again soon.
Okay. Thanks, Ed.